I am happily here at Penn teaching courses on Einstein and Picasso and one on the science of Leonardo. So when I was asked to do something for bioethics, I thought, oh, this is going to be cool. I can put that together. So let us start. We're going to be talking a lot about life and how we handle life in this lecture. I always like to start at the top. There is God giving man life. We'll come back to that a little later. The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It's the source of all true art and science, Albert Einstein said. I'll get you used to science and art before we get into the bioethics. This is Leonardo's Vitruvius Man, a perfect example of science and art from the Renaissance. Edward O. Wilson, who is the Pulitzer winning author and Harvard professor of biology. The arts, like the sciences, start in the real world, then reach out to cue all possible worlds, and finally to all conceivable worlds. And you have to ask, why did we even create art to begin with? What was that about? These drawings on the caves. And I always ask, is the desire to create art genetically encoded in the human condition or in the animal condition? And in the animal condition, we find the bowerbirds. Who knows about the bowerbirds? Who here knows about them? Yeah. They're found in Australia, New Guinea, New Zealand. And they make these beautiful, beautiful, to them, beautiful bowers. And they pick up, it's the bluebird always has these blue things. And the females go from bower to bower to bower, trying to figure out which one has done the best art, and that's the one she will mate with, oddly enough. Now, is it a bioethical issue if man should come along and move a little piece of art? Well, it's not, because the bird will just pick it up and put it back in place. It looks junky to us, but they have, so art is encoded in the animal species in some way. Martin Kemp, the Leonardo scholar, says it's evolutionary, but it's gone way, way, way beyond evolution. So why art? Edward O. Wilson says these drawings back then, he believes, gave the artist a sense of power over his environment. If you have to go kill the bison, this gives you the power. And in fact, there is an idea throughout art that if you can make something, you're as good as God, because God has made all of these things. That was a big idea in the Renaissance, and we don't know what they were actually thinking 40,000 years ago, but that's Edward O. Wilson's concept of it. But Darwin said all of aesthetics is, put simply, about the survival of the species. When we look at the next painting by Leonardo, it's hard to argue, although I think today she'd probably get a nose job. What do you think? Today. She's not considered a sexy being, but she's considered an ethereal classic beauty. So we're going to talk about Leonardo, who, the more I study Leonardo, the more in awe of him I am. I can't believe that there was a human being on this planet who did what Leonardo did. He said, human subtlety will never devise an invention more beautiful, more simple, or more direct than does nature, because in her inventions nothing is lacking and nothing is superfluous. He was born the illegitimate son of a notary in Vinci, and because he was illegitimate, he wasn't allowed a typical Renaissance education. He couldn't study the classics. He lived with his grandparents in Tuscany, and he hung out with his uncle, and they roamed the hills of the Tuscan hills, and he drew them. He loved drawing them. He had a lot of studies about water. These are from later in his life, and actually one of my students did a examination of this drawing, saying it's like a computer image today of movement, but he put it all in one frame. By the way, Leonardo hid all of his work, all of his scientific work, in an elaborate system of pulleys and drapes and would put them downstairs, put them upstairs, hid them, because there was the concern that he might be accused of heresy by the church during the Renaissance. So we actually didn't know about all of his science for hundreds of years. After he died, they were scattered throughout Europe, and it was a great loss. We are studying right now whether he would have been considered the father of anatomy, the father of fractal science, the father of the Gaia theory, all of that. Now we're looking back that we have his work. And his work has really been reinterpreted. His work has been reinterpreted throughout the generations, by each generation, according to each generation. If you look at the Mona Lisa, he didn't have a lot of paintings, 30, maybe only 30 paintings. If you look at the Mona Lisa, you'll see that the landscape is as much a part of his work as she is. When it came to being an artist, I mean, he was an artist who felt that you really had to understand what was underneath the skin in order to draw it well or to paint it well. And in doing so, he began to do autopsies. He was such a good artist, by the time he was 20, he became a member of the Guild de San Luca, which included not just artists, but also physicians. And it was at the Hospital de Santa Maria Nuova in Florence where he did his dissections, his autopsies. And he did them in the middle of the night and in secret also, because he was afraid. And because he was curious. Kenneth Clark, the art historian, said he was the most curious man ever. But he wrote. He wrote to people who were maybe thinking of doing this kind of work. He said, "You will perhaps be impeded by your stomach. And if this does not impede you, you will perhaps be impeded by the fear of living through the night hours in the company of these corpses quartered and played and frightening to behold." You'll see here, not only was he studying the musculature of man, but this, and skeleton, this is a dog. He had access to animals in slaughterhouses that he would dissect also. By the way, he was a vegetarian. He felt that he knew that animals had pain, and he'd go to markets and buy little caged birds just to set them free. So he was really, you know, a man of generous spirit toward animals, but he did draw them, and man too. I mean, these are extraordinary. I don't think I've ever seen drawings this beautiful, anatomical drawings this beautiful. The skull. Art historian Bernard Berenson said, "Leonardo is one of the artists of whom it may be said with perfect literalness, nothing he touched but turned into a thing of eternal beauty. Whether it be a cross-section of a skull, the structure of a weave, study of muscles, he, with his feeling for line and for light and for shade, forever transmuted it into a life-communicating value." His first dissection, it is told, was of a man who was over 100 years old. And he wrote about him. He said, "This old man, a few hours before his death, told me he was over 100 years old, and he felt nothing wrong with his body other than weakness. And thus, while sitting on a bed in the hospital of Santa Maria Nuova in Florence, without any movement or any other sign of mishap, he passed out of the life. And I made an anatomy of him in order to see the cause of so sweet a death." I'll get to that. He found the cause of the death, which was interesting. He studied the eye, the brain, the ventricles of the brain. How did the eye work? He was fascinated with how the eye worked. He was the first one that realized that the uterus had veins and arteries going into it. During that time, they thought the uterus, if somebody had twins, there were two uteri, is that the word, uteri? And he was the first one to say there's only one. But the man that died, he realized that the man who had so sweet a death was because his arteries were clogged. It was the first diagnosed case of arteriosclerosis. His studies of the heart are extraordinary. During his period, people thought that the liver created pumped the blood and the heart just warmed it. So he was the first one to say, the heart really pumps the blood. Are these beautiful or what? Studied the veins in the neck, arteries in the neck. And this you might recognize as sex. This is Sexual Intercourse by Leonardo da Vinci. You get it? Do you see it? Who doesn't see it? There it is. I think it's even ejaculating a little bit here. And he's also was remarkable in doing this drawing of the fetus. I imagine the woman died because it looks like it was a breech birth. And he, they say the problem with the placenta is that it's way too big, more like a cow's placenta. But this is just so beautiful and so extraordinary. He worked with a guy named, a doctor named Mark Antonio Della Torre. Together they were preparing a book about autopsies and anatomy. And Del Torre died of the plague, and that stopped. But for him, Leonardo was really afraid of heresy, and he had reason to be. In 1514, he was brought in front of the Vatican, being accused of witchcraft and dealing with the dead, communing with the dead. And only because he was such a good artist, and by the way, because he was such a good artist, he used it to study his science, and it was a science of observation. But the Vatican did not put him to death, but they told him that he had to stop. He had to stop doing these autopsies. And he ended up not being the father of anatomy. Vesalius got that honor. And, you know, Vesalius's book on anatomy was published in 1543. And I don't know that we think it's more beautiful than all of these. I think these are more beautiful. And we did not see the publishing of Leonardo's work until 1680. It was put together as his treatise on painting. But Vesalius got the title. I put this in, this is actually by Galileo, and even though it's not bioethics, Galileo, by the way, studied art. He studied it at the Academy in Florence, and because he studied art, he knew when he looked through his telescope at the moon that he was looking at craters and mountains, and of course we know that he was actually sentenced to death for heresy, for saying the sun does not go around the earth goes around the sun. So you had to take the threat of heresy very seriously in the Renaissance. They made him take it back, and he took it back, and he lived in house arrest for the rest of his life. By the way, Leonardo came to the same conclusion. Leonardo said, the sun does not move. But he didn't publish it. He was too smart to do that. I just show a couple little other beautiful drawings from the Renaissance, Albert Dürer's from the north. Tall grass, it looks so real. And again, remember, if you could do something like this, it was godlike, it was divine. In fact, Leonardo was called Il Divino. He was by everybody called, they thought that his kind of talent had to be God-given. So if you could make something like that, it was godlike. Dürer also. And there's the rabbit, the most beautiful, wonderful rabbit I've ever seen. And we're going to have kind of a theme of rabbits in the rest of the lecture, so I just thought I'd show you this rabbit. Notice it has no background. It has very fabulous ears. I mean, just magnificent ears. And Dürer actually signed his name, and most people in the Renaissance didn't. I'm going to jump to Audubon. Audubon, as we know, did hit the birds of America, the animals of America. And what was interesting about Audubon is that he put the animals in their natural environment. So he was a natural historian as well as a pretty decent artist. So you know something about how the animal lived. He did mostly birds. They're very famous, these parrots from the Carolinas. And you see the backgrounds and how the animals live. What is awful about Audubon is that in order to draw these birds, he killed them. And he was actually a very, very good taxidermist. And I was filming for the series, oh, this is one of my favorites, the pileated woodpecker. Who's ever seen one of those? Aren't they amazing? They're this big, and they fly like a pterodactyl. They're just really incredible. I was filming an exhibit on Darwin's influence on art, and they had a lot of Audubons, and they also had drawers of the dead birds, which really grossed me out. And then this came up. I actually own this. One of my favorite artists said that this little bird got caught in his studio, and he painted it. His assistant brought it to him, warm and dead. He painted it and then buried it in his backyard. But Audubon, who killed the birds in order to paint them while they were alive, this guy painted the dead bird in order to honor his life, and that touched me very much. So even though you think it's kind of a gross painting, the instincts behind it were very, very tender. And Sibley, as we know, is Audubon's latest star, the Audubon Society's latest star. He was drawing birds when he was five. He talks to them. He knows them very well. And he'll say, "Why are you fat and why are you skinny? Your cousins, you know, your cousins, why are you fat, why are you skinny?" Turns out the fat one had a longer flight to migrate. But he doesn't kill the birds. And he really can photograph them now, which is great. But then we get to this. It's one thing for to do it with animals, but when you start getting to the humans, what do you think of this? Who's seen the exhibits? What did you think? Anybody?
It was really incredible.
Beautiful?
They captured just so many different aspects with the different methods they used.
That's Von Hagens. Von Hagens would sign his name at the bottom, just like it was a work of art. And this is the plastinated bodies showing all sorts of things. There's some issues, excuse me, involved with it. One is, where do you get the bodies? Big bioethical issue, where do you get the bodies? Van Dorgen says Van Hagens gets all of his from donations. If you go to his website, you can donate your body to science and end up maybe like that. He puts the men in heroic positions and people love it, and it's really sort of over the top and amazing. But he had a worker who was obtaining bodies from China, and they looked and saw that six of the bodies had bullet holes in the skull. So they had been people who had been executed in China. And Von Hagen got very upset with that, fired that worker, and there's two reports about what he did with the bodies. One says he had them buried immediately, and the other one said that he sent them back to the Dalian Medical University where they got them. The guy who got fired actually started his own plastin, I can't say the word. Somebody say it for me. Plastinated? Plastination. Started his own plastination. And there's another group going around the world of these bodies, and they are Chinese looking. And that's the other guy. Now, the question of where he gets the bodies, he says he gets the bodies from the police, who say these bodies have been abandoned or executed. But it's a big deal. The premier of the other group says that all the bodies were legally obtained from the police because they were found and unclaimed. Countries around the world have been protesting this. This is one of the steps in the plastinization They actually do slices of whole bodies. So you can see a slice. That, I think, is a brain. This is the inside your abdominal cavity. Those are the lungs of a smoker. Beautiful heart. They go out of their way to make sure the veins look blue and the arteries look red. This is a dissection of a heart. These, I believe, are lungs and not kidneys. Those are lungs. And he too went to animals. The animals are coming from China. But there's another issue involved with these plastinations. Thank you. And that is the dignity of the human body. Was anybody who saw them like thought it was disrespectful? Yeah? Yes? You did? You didn't? Well, let me give you some quotes of people. One said they reduce the subject of the manipulation of body parts to just something for money. I have a couple more quotes. Anita Allen, she teach here? Is she here?
She's a fellow at Center.
Yeah, but she said, she argued that spending money to gawk at human remains should raise serious concerns. Elaine Katz, who helped coordinate the Carnegie Science Center's exhibit, actually resigned, saying that it teaches that once he's a deceased, there's nothing wrong with taking a person's body without his consent, that there's nothing wrong with exploiting the dead in order to make a profit as long as it is in the name of science or education or art. It teaches that it is incredibly easy to dehumanize others. So there's a bioethical issue there that one can talk about. Art, who's not here, said, it's educational to see how the body works in motion. If it's done artistically and tastefully, it's fine. Anybody want to talk about it? Anybody want to talk about whether or not this is cool? He's now doing animals, as I said. This is pretty spectacular. Hello. And look at that. Now, we have to assume that the animals died or were euthanized because they weren't well, that they were properly donated. But there are a lot of questions about whether or not this really dehumanizes man or whether it's a really beautiful exhibit of what goes on inside our bodies. There's another, somebody was also complaining that the men looked heroic and the women were reproductive. Mm-hmm. So there was a sexist angle of complaint, too. Damien Hirst. Has anybody seen that one? You saw it in London? At the Saatchi Gallery? Yeah, when I saw that at London in the Saatchi Gallery, I thought I was going to throw up. Physical impossibility of death in the mind of someone living. Actually, those three boxes can separate, and you can see the cross-section of the shark. What's kind of gross about it, besides it's being gross, is that he specifically ordered a shark to be killed in Australia for this. That's how he got the shark. He had fishermen in Australia kill the shark. And the first time he tried to put it together, it's in a fluid of acrylic and formaldehyde. The first time he did it, it just kind of rotted and got disgusting, so he did it again. Damien Hirst is actually fascinated with the ideas of mortality. His main themes is the impossibility of accepting it, and he has dead and rotting animals, and he doesn't really care. While he was an art student, he actually worked in a mortuary, which might have influenced why he's fascinated with the concept of death and trying to contemplate death. Here he took a skull and put diamonds over it and sold it for something like $20 million. The question is he just spectacle or is this art? I mean, what is this? Do we Oh, that's his self-portrait. More sharks, sheep, cows cut in half. He says about the cows, you know, what the heck? We eat hamburgers all the time. Maybe we should just look at them as hamburgers. This is a cow in sections. That's a cow cut down the middle. This is his crucifixion. And this, I think, is actually kind of sweet. It's his unicorn. He took a horse and put a horn on it. But how do you feel about what Damien Hirst does to animals? Anybody? Yeah.
At the Natural History Museum in Chicago, there is an exhibit of a man who had been cut on a bandsaw lengthwise, and a woman cut sections like this. They're in formaldehyde, and you can go see them. They were black people. And at one time, this was a very great educational thing. Now that people can go and study it. It's totally useless now in terms of education. There's much, much better specimens, much more using MRI, CT, really better. This bothers me. The body works bothered me. I've seen plenty of bodies in all states of good and bad, and it just seemed unnecessary.
Okay. Yeah, well, anybody else have a comment?
I think for educational purposes, it's not bad. I mean, the medical students.
I mean, but the animals. What about the animals here? These animals. Do you think the same thing?
I don't really see what that's pointless to me.
Yeah.
Is someone going to object if you use an animal's fur in a piece of
that? Well, and we do eat animals, right?
You know, when we eat animals, exactly.
We kill them anyway.
Is it different just to make it more obvious that you're using the whole animal?
Yeah, he has. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, it's in front of you as opposed to making it more subtle, but.
Yeah.
It's the same.
Yeah, so I mean, we have bioethical issues to discuss when it comes to Damien Hirst. But I particularly was struck by this chimeric image, the unicorn, because we're going to actually go to an animal who doesn't exist in nature. I told you the theme was bunnies. Eduardo Kac, anybody know who he is? He is from Brazil, an artist from Brazil, who's now the head of science and technology at the Chicago Art Institute. And he's into digital art and into what's called transgenic art. So if you take an albino bunny, the embryo of an albino bunny, and put the phosphorescent gene from a jellyfish in it, you get the bunny that glows in the dark. And that was supposed to be a digital exhibit in Avignon, and the director of the museum said, oh, can we have the bunny from the lab that made it? And the lab that made it said no. Originally, the bunny was supposed to be going home with Eduardo Kac and his family. It was his daughter who named it Alba, which means white. And it does glow in the dark. Can you imagine how long it would exist in nature? Maybe a night. Young. This is Kac with the bunny, with Alba himself. And let me just show you some more. This is the, the tortoise and the hare. I am something else. Un autre. Just un autre. Something else entirely, yes. Not a rabbit. This is Brazil. I mean, it was a hit. It was a real hit. This is Copacabana Beach. This is in France, the street signs. This is a poster. This is his house. He put the little flag out, hoping that Alba would come home to him. And this is, again, in Brazil. So the question is, what was it? What was it? And he says transgenic arts is transgenic animals are often talked about as objects. And what he was really trying to do was to, make us realize that they're social creatures. They want to be hugged, touched, petted. They're alive. If we're going to be fiddling around with genetics and making creatures that don't exist in nature, we better have a conversation about it. That's what he's about. Let's have a conversation about it. He really, well, was heartbroken that he couldn't take the bunny home and raise it like a normal bunny. But he wanted to contextualize their existence and start the conversation. He has a big website of people making comments about transgenic. He says, my work doesn't visualize science. It's not meant to duplicate the information that circulates from science to the media to the public. It's meant to intervene, to change, to criticize, to point out, to reflect, and modify. He includes not only the process of bringing Alba into the world and integrating her into society, but also deliberately provoking the fears, imaginations, and hopes we have attached to genetics and the new life forms. So the issue is one of creating a new life form. I think it's really rather cool, but.
I think it's rather cool or cruel?
Oh, without the R. Without the R. I mean, I don't think I'd like to see them hopping around in nature because they wouldn't live very long, but it I don't know, I guess I like rabbits. And also, somebody might have an issue of creating nature into a product. So, I mean, there are a lot of things to discuss with this. And also, with Damien Hirst and with this, you're looking at the increasingly blurry distinction between art, science, and life. In Kak's case, the idea that an artist's work of art could actually be the creation of life is frightening to people. And then where's the power? This has to do with whom you trust in culture. But this transgenic gene, who's taken freshman biology? I mean, not this transgenic, the phosphorescent gene. Did you use the phosphorescent gene from a jellyfish to examine? It's a very easy thing to do, and it's commonly used in science. So it wasn't such a bizarre thing for him to put it into, have it put into an embryo. And if you go to a pet store and you look at the fish, a lot of them are glowing around, and they have had the phosphorescent gene put into them because people like things that glow. Here are some green mice that were made. It's real easy to do. But this is something new. This is Eduardo Cax. He calls it Edunia. It's his gene in with a petunia. The red is from the human gene of Eduardo Cax, and the pink is from the petunia. Looks like a normal petunia. There he is watering it. And it expresses his DNA only in those red veins. This is how he did it. I'm not going to get into it, but he does on his website explain how they cut a little bit of his DNA from the blood and put it into the petunia so it could grow. It was developed between 2003 and 2008. It was displayed at the museum. Isn't that fun? And it's called part of something called the Natural History of the Enigma. Red veins on light pink petals. I just think that's so funny. The gene he selected is responsible for the identification of foreign bodies. That's what it, in this work, it is precisely that which identifies and rejects the others that integrate into the other, thus creating a new kind of self that is partially flower and partially human. And now we're contemplating not just transgenic animals, but we're contemplating animal-human species. Ooh. I'm going to just jump a little bit to somebody who's looking at flowers through x-rays, and they're actually quite beautiful. But when you take it to humans, artist Nick Vizi, you have to ask, how much x-ray are you exposing people to? And is this a decent thing to be doing? But as I explored him more and more, I couldn't get that really answered, but I realized that there's only the same person being used. So he was probably just doing it to himself. So can we argue with that? You know, it's the same person. He also uses a skeleton rather than people, but this is definitely not a skeleton. I love Amelia Panico's work. Let me see if I can get it up there. She is a... she's a photographer at Sloan Kettering. And I don't know that there are any bioethical issues here, but her stuff is so beautiful. It's just photography. And she actually is, you can compare her, what she does, to what Leonardo thought of. He thought the veins and rivers were the same. I'm just going to go through this very quickly. I love the fish in the chromosomes, Dolly the sheep and the formulas, the apes coming out of the mist. I don't know what that is. My students love this one, I don't know why. This is like really interesting, the roots looking like veins. And we're done with that. Oh, I'm supposed to hit PowerPoint. Okay, and we're back. And then as the gentleman over there was talking about, today we have Alex Tsiaras, who starts with CAT scans and merges layers and photographs into pictures of the human body. And sometimes his work is compared to Leonardo's drawings. He also has created, it's called the Anatomical Travel, and some of his stuff is the green one, used for medical school. He's these beautiful, beautiful, beautiful images. Well, I'm not getting this. But anyway, it's something to look at. It's called let me go back to PowerPoint. It's called the anatomicaltravel.com. His stuff is really beautiful. I'm going to go back to the beginning, to the top, as it were, to the brain, which people have been fascinated with forever and ever. Simmer Zeki, who is a neurobiologist, says the function of art is an extension of the function of the brain, the seeking of knowledge in an ever-changing world. And if we go back to the top and compare this to the Sistine Chapel, look at the thing that's behind God, the cartouche that's behind God. I'll go back and do it again. Oh, isn't that interesting? It was the cover of the journal The AMA in 1990. A neurosurgeon did an analysis of the shape of the cartouche and came to the conclusion that, yes, it was a brain, and that Michelangelo was giving man not just life, but a mind as well. And actually, they now are saying there are many different body parts found throughout the Sistine Chapel. But anyway, that's what I have. Now, I have brought, if we have time, do we have time? Mm-hmm. I have brought the first 7 minutes of my promo reel, which also brings up a bioethical issue. I don't know how to close this. Got it. Okay. Let me make sure we have some sound here. And this is the promo wheel for my series.
They sprung forth together, essentially. Art is in science, and science is in art.
Ideas are guiding both scientific inquiry and artistic production simultaneously.
The artist reaches an intuitive understanding without knowing anything about the brain. He reaches an intuitive understanding that this works.
As human beings, we are immensely inventive. We are the species, the creature, which above all reshapes the world. In art, we've developed this to a point where it obviously satisfies us deeply. So I think it's an evolutionary thing, but it's gone way beyond the evolutionary need.
They both try and represent a reality beyond appearances. Both artists and scientists know that there is something there. Essentially, what you see is not always what you get.
What the Renaissance revives is an ancient Greek and Roman idea, and that is essentially the human being has been placed on earth or made as the way of understanding it. So you begin to get a phase where, to revive a very ancient tag, which was much quoted in the Renaissance, man is the measure of all things. Describing Leonardo is difficult. Do you describe as an artist, a scientist, an engineer, an anatomist, a botanist, a zoologist, or whatever? For him, science meant systematic knowledge. Therefore, painting is a kind of science, because you investigate the visual world and you express your understanding of the visual world in the painting. For Leonardo, nothing is static. The whole earth is moving in this great surging dynamic form, which, like all organisms, changes and adapts and undergoes transformations.
The great thinkers and artists of the Enlightenment put their faith in the ability of human reason to fathom the truth in nature. There is an extraordinary desire to capture the appearance of an object, that capturing the appearance of an object gives you some kind of understanding or power over that object. The other part of it, though, is of communication. Artists responded to Darwin almost immediately, because his ideas about natural selection and what came to be called survival of the fittest lent themselves so extraordinarily well to storytelling. Both Audubon and Darwin have their roots in the 18th century obsession with classification, and this broader question of the physical relationships between different forms of life. The different life phases of birds and the way their appearance changed had confounded classifiers, and Audubon studies them in their natural environments. He was one of the first serious natural historians who was also an extremely well-trained and talented artist. His illustrations convey extraordinary amounts of scientific information. We have art informing science, but it is also art that is informed by science. The scientists studying these animals saw them as the artistic productions of nature that were governed by the same laws of aesthetics that art production was. Fierce Friends contains a wonderful Turner representing Noah's flood. It's called the deluge. And you can see these sort of vague forms of animals heading frantically in the direction of the ark. And then in the lower right corner is this very strange alligator-like creature with a pointy snout who is not going to make it. He is based on the iguanodon, one of the earliest dinosaurs discovered in the 19th century. And Turner has painted this little iguanodon to attempt to explain or reconcile the discovery of fossilized animal bones with biblical history and biblical creation.
that's all I wanted to show you of that. It ends again with a bioethical question, and one of the big ones, and that's the relationships between creationism and evolution. But during the time of Darwin, when they were discovering these ancient things, these ancient bones, even artists were absolutely not knowing quite what to do about all of that. So that's when oh, look at my desktop, excuse me. What a mess. I better turn this off. Shut down, yes.
We can just mute it.
Okay.
Any questions? I mean, I think we've brought up a couple of really interesting things that has to do with life, preserving life, ending life, showing life, creating life, in all sorts of new ways that art is exploring. Any questions or comments? Yeah.
What are you going to have to do to get the series on the air?
Raise a lot of money.
About how much?
A couple million. I have 1 hour completely shot, and that's the hour on physics and, the hour on the restoration of art. I've shot the restoration of art that was damaged by Katrina at Winterthur, and I filmed the authentication of a little lost and found Leonardo, which was really quite special. And I filmed the manufacturers of oil paint for artists in America. So that hour is pretty much shot. But the other hours are art, nature, art and physics, and art in the brain. Art in the brain was interesting. I spent a summer with Samir Zeki in University College London, who charted the visual brain. And we were doing fMRIs on people looking at art. And basically, we see color first. We see line and form second. We see motion third, oddly enough, except for peripheral vision motion, which goes through the brain in a very different pathway than the rest of vision. So that was a really interesting thing to be doing. Any other questions? Yeah?
Sort of a medium question. When you were talking about body worlds, about sort of whether or not what he was doing dehumanized subjects, yet with a lot of illustrations, we talk about the humanism that artists can put into their work when they're depicting the human body,
right,
even through dissection.
Right.
Question, but it's sort of about, is there something about the medium, the fact that these are human bodies, and why that should sort of necessarily make...
Why people should be shocked by it?
Right.
Well,
you just expand a little bit more on that.
Certainly the religious groups are shocked by it. Judaism, rabbis and priests are shocked by it because you can't, a body is not supposed to be handled in that way. It's supposed to be very quickly put in the ground in Judaism. Not even supposed to have a tattoo. It's the handling of the body. It seems to dehumanize according to some religions. But you know, I actually don't, except for Damien Hirst, don't have really strong opinions about it. I just see it as a topic that needs to be discussed more. But people seem to be outraged. There have been a lot of, actually I have a long list here, which I, you saw me turning pages, a long list of laws that were, you know, countries that wouldn't let them in. Actually, Damien Hirst, America wouldn't let the dead animals in, particularly the cows because of mad cow disease. We weren't importing British cows, and he had to try to convince everybody it was really a work of art, not food. And but you know, want me to read some of the Scotland Human Tissue Act of 2006 said licenses for the handling of human remains, including display, must be granted directly by the Scottish Ministry. Here in the U.S., national legislation on consent and tissue donation issues expressed in the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act of 2006. California bill proposed, sponsored by Assemblywoman Fiona Ma, would require exhibitors to get a county permit to do so. They would have to prove to the county health officials that the people whose cadavers were on display or their next of kin had consented. Florida, prohibits the sale or purchase of human remains and authorizes certain science centers located in the state to transport plastinated bodies into, within, or out of the state and exhibit such bodies for the purpose of public education without the consent of the state's anatomical board. If the science center notifies the board of any such transportation or exhibition, as well, they must at least 30 days before such transportation or exhibit. Hawaii, Representative Marcos Oshiro introduced two bills prompted by the presentation of the bodies exhibit in that state. They have a bill that relating to dead human bodies that would add to the prohibition against buying dead human bodies. I mean, those kinds of issues. People are going to be buying body parts. The selling of dead human bodies, it defines the term dead human body to include plastinated bodies and body parts. It would increase the fine for buying and selling a dead human body up to $5,000. Would prohibit the display of dead human bodies without a permit from the Department of Health. In New York, 2008, New York State Senate passed legislation requiring regulating body exhibits. The bill was sponsored by Senator Jim Alessi, requiring anybody to show an exhibit that used real human bodies to produce a permit detailing the origin. Pennsylvania Mike Fleck's proposed bill would require evidence of informed consent. So, Catholic Church and Jewish rabbis have objected to the display of human remains, stating that it's inconsistent with reverence toward the human body. The Bishop of Manchester in England launched a campaign to coincide with the opening of Body Worlds in that city, accusing exhibitors of being body snatchers, arguing that donation of bodies for plastination would deprive the National Health Service of organs for transplant. The site included a government petition for calling for a review of the law regarding the policies and practices of touring shows involved with corpses. Consent is the primary focus of discussion. Paul Harris, director of North Carolina State Board of Funeral Services, stated, somebody at some level of government should be able to look at a death certificate, a statement from an embalmer, donation documents. It's a reasonable standard to apply. So that's really where the body's coming from. Have they been authenticated, you know, have they been properly donated and documented? That's pretty much what it's about. Yeah?
Along those lines, was there any, like, legal or, I guess, media outrage when they discovered the six bodies in China?
Yes.
Like, what do you have? And others?
Well, actually, when they discovered the six bodies from China, Der Spiegel continued to talk about it to the point that Body Worlds von Hagen sued them. I mean, he said that we took care of that. That's over with. We're not getting illegal bodies in, you know, and we didn't want them. So there was a big brouhaha. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What was his goal in using actual human bodies? I mean, was he trying to shock and provoke people, or trying to, like, make people take a closer look at the human body? I mean, it seems like he could have actually just used synthetic materials. Like, he didn't have to use human bodies, except that it probably wouldn't have had really the impact that it had.
In his history, I mean, I don't think I have a copy of his own history, but in his history, he had learned how to do this, and then decided, yes, this is a thing to do. I mean, to preserve a body in this way. He was doing it originally for slicing, for studies, for lab studies, the plastinization, because you have to put it in some kind of element in order to slice them for microscopic studies. And once he learned how to do that, he thought, okay, let's do it as art. And he considers it art. Yeah.
It's interesting with him, too, is when he started in Europe, the presentations were more in gallery spaces or industrial spaces, and he had much more intensive focus on the signatures and the artistic aspect.
Yeah.
It was when he came to the United States, he was sort of a chameleon, because then he said, all right, I'm going to avoid that trouble. I'm going to go to science museums.
Yeah.
The institution of science helped justify. Mm-hmm. And the presentation style, from what I understand, didn't change very much. I mean,
no, they look artistic, and he signs his name at the bottom as if it were a work of art. Yeah.
What's written on the wall behind it has changed. Like,
a little bit, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, he does also usually has corners of the exhibit that are curtained off that have fetuses and other things in it that they don't recommend for children. And the response of children at these museums is also a concern for many people. But those things they have private for adults only, or take special care, it might upset you. They have signs up for that. Yeah. Yeah.
If I can change the topic.
Sure.
Are you interested at all in the ways in which artistic thinking might enter the actual work of doing science?
Yes. I teach a course on Einstein and Picasso, and I teach a course on Leonardo, the science of Leonardo, but because he was both an artist and a scientist, yes. And one of the issues is that particularly in today's world, when we're dealing with things that are so tiny, nanoscience and all of that, how you visualize science becomes more and more important. And the people who are like winning Nobel Prizes actually often are the visual thinkers. Einstein and Poincaré were playing around with relativity at the same time, but Einstein asked a better question. It was a visual question. What would happen if I were riding on a beam of light?
Oh, yeah.
Raoul Hoffman, who is a chemist, won his Nobel. He was working with some kind of atom, and he was, can I draw with this? So, you know, an atom looks like that, and the electrons go around and around. Well, he was having a hard time, and he decided, what if the electrons did this, and they were loops, and they were hooked to other atoms that way? And when he began to visualize it, he was able to get the work done that led to his Nobel Prize.
Do you have any sense of what sort of educational backgrounds or work in the visual arts or exposure to the visual arts some of these people might have had? Who are
scientists?
Calling visual thinkers. It's scientists who are visual thinkers.
Interesting. I mean, as I said, Galileo studied art.
There's somebody at Harvard Medical School, Donald Ingram,
mm-hmm.
who studies cells. And
go ahead.
Do you know the kind of cell?
Go ahead.
Story. Yeah, he was taking at Yale a course in sculpture,
uh-huh.
and encountered the what are called tensegrity sculptures
mm-hmm.
of Kenneth Snelson, in which you know there are struts and poles that operate almost like flying buttresses. I mean, they're sort of oppositional forces that hold these things up, and they span bodies of water, and they're quite stunning. And he was also taking a cell biology course. And he started thinking about the cell, not in terms of nucleus and so forth, but in terms of the structure that was holding the cell together, and discovered these sort of ligaments that control the shape of the cell. So a balled-up cell is going to multiply more quickly than a flat cell, which will cause healing because it spans over
yeah.
wider
surface. Yeah.
But, I mean, he credits his study of art.
Yeah.
For some of his thinking.
Yes, yes. That I think that visual
thinking.
That's
really an unexplored, you know, just.
I don't know if that it's that unexplored. I think, you know,
yeah.
Arthur I. Miller is exploring. He's written a book called Insights of Genius, Visualizations in Science. Arthur I. Miller. He's also the author of my book on Einstein and Picasso. There was that story, and I'm not sure it's true, about a guy named Kulicki who discovered the benzene ring, and it was like he had a dream that it was a snake biting its tail, you know, and oh, it's a ring, it's not something else, it's a ring. And I was at a conference on science at art at the New York Academy of Sciences, and there was a professor from Stony Brook who was doing biochemistry and cell metabolism. And what was interesting is he said, if you draw the cell with everything that's in it, it's too complicated for the students to understand. And so he suggests a simplified version of the visual in order to bring the students up to speed on the metabolism of the cell, which I thought was really interesting. Too. So I think there's a lot of work being done on the visualization in science. I just don't know how public it is, and I hope to make it more public. Yeah. But that's interesting about the self. Anything else? Well, I want to thank you. You have another one?
Yeah, if Leonardo were alive today, what kind of research would he be attracted to?
You know, I asked my students that. I had them write an in-class essay. If Leonardo were alive today, what would he be doing? And it was like a Rorschach test. One person said he would have just completed his book on the anatomy of animals and would be a veterinarian. One person said they would have classified him as having ADHD and he would be depressed and not be able to do anything. I thought that was the Rorschach. And that was my most brilliant student said that, and most depressed. They said a lot of things. Some people said he would be a fractal scientist.
What do you think?
What do I think?
Yeah.
He'd be Stephen Jobs, maybe. Silence? Why did I say that? Because he was also very, he cared about the way things look. He had a beautiful eye. He was fantastic. But he also was very, he made his living by making machines and war toys, and not war toys, but he made machines and he made instruments of war, and he came up with all sorts of gadgets. That's how he really made his living, not by his art, and not certainly not by his science. So I think he'd probably do something commercial and be very successful, but it would be beautiful. You know, Steve Jobs studied calligraphy before he dropped out, or while he dropped out, and he understood the importance of the aesthetic, even in a machine. So, as did Leonardo. Maybe he'd be Steve Jobs, or just something like that. I think he'd be fascinated by today's world. He'd be... I also asked my students, if Einstein were alive today, what would he think of it? And it's only been since 56. And they said he would hate string theory, that he would be overwhelmed by the communications technology. He wouldn't like it at all. It's too fast. He would like to sit down and think. It's too fast.
Probably could have used a GPS.
Well, actually, you want to hear something amazing, that what got Einstein thinking about visual science was when he was 5 years old and his father got him a compass. And he couldn't believe that he could walk around and the compass would always point to the same place. No matter where he was, it pointed to the same place. And he said at that time he knew there was something deeply hidden behind things. So, yeah, GPS was the originating issue for him. It actually was. Anything else? Well, I thank you so much for inviting me. I hope you enjoyed this, and I enjoyed it. We didn't all fall asleep, just you. Thank you.
Beautiful.
you know, a lot of medical illustration, a lot of birds.
Beautiful.
And it would love,
I would love this stuff.
But
yes.
I'll get your copy.
Okay. Thank you. Hi, dear.
Again, you're not the cover of the ball.
Huh?
You're not the cover of the ball.
Cover of the ball?
I said, again, you're not the cover of the ball.
Oh, did you like it?
I
didn't stumble too much.